From the National Urban League, this is For the Movement, a podcast that discusses persistent policy, social, and civil rights issues affecting communities of color. I'm Clint Odom, Senior Vice President of Policy and Executive Director of the Washington Bureau.
And I'm Toni Wiley, Director of Advocacy for the National Urban League. So this week, we are talking to Ms. Nkechi Taifa, and what we're talking about with her is our second segment on reparations, which focuses on the psychic healing of slavery and how reparations can play a role in that. Ms. Taifa is an attorney who owns her own firm here in D.C. called the Taifa Group. But despite her youthfulness that you're going to hear when she's interviewing with us, she has been on the front lines of advocating, studying, and working for the reparations movement for many, many years. And two of the organizations that she was involved in were really interesting to me. One of them was called NCOBRA, which stands for the National Coalition of Blacks for Reparations in America. It was founded in 1987, and it seeks financial compensation for the descendants of former slaves in America. So it makes no apologies. It is absolutely about getting those checks to African-American descendants of slaves. It also advocates for government, corporations, and individuals who benefited from slave labor to pay an undisclosed amount, which could be approximately $8 trillion based on 2008 estimates. And that would be approximately $205,000 to each African-American person living in the U.S. right now. So that's a pretty hefty amount of change for someone to be getting for reparations. I would definitely appreciate $205,000.
Yeah, I could use that to pay Skip Gates to prove that I'm a descendant of African slaves.
I think you would be all right, and you could probably save that money for something more fun.
Putting these four kids through college.
That sounds fun.
Yeah, a new whip, maybe.
Oh, maybe. There's a lot of course, controversy on whip African Americans should do with their reparations, should they get it. But that's the amount that NCOBRA estimates as of 2008. And I'm sure that that number has grown since then. They also say that reparations doesn't have to be in the form of checks per se, but it could include reissuing of land that was stolen, economic development projects, and also other monetary sources, which could be like scholarships or other monetary derivatives that don't necessarily require a paper check to be cut to someone. The other group that she worked with is called NARC, the National African American Reparations Commission, and that was formed in 2015. And it is also a group of distinguished professionals from across the country in the fields of law, medicine, journalism, academia, history, civil rights, and social justice advocacy. And they share very similar goals to NCOBRA, but they also created a 10-point reparations plan, which once a reparations commission is established through the U.S. government, hopefully they would forward those recommendations to that group. A lot of the members of this group and the founding members of this group have already served on commissions that were established by Representative Conyers when he first started reparations commissions. They are well versed in all areas of reparations and how that looks from a government standpoint. Some of the things that they mentioned in their 10-point plan was repatriation to Africa, making that available to African descendants of slaves, U.S. land transfers we've already talked about, development of cooperative enterprises and responsible entrepreneurship centers for African Americans, and also resources for health, wealth, and healing of Black families and communities. I guess that kind of brings us to our topic today, which is what role should reparations play in the healing of the psychic wounds of slavery that African Americans and pretty much anybody in this country who's had to live under that and the aftermath of that have experienced?
Well, I'll tell you, this resonated a lot with me because if you look at the reparations efforts that have taken place across the globe and even here in the United States, they all seem to have a common element that they begin with an apology. Mm-hmm. And for those of us who pay a lot of attention to what's going on in politics these days, we know that apologies don't come easy. even when you wrong as wrong can be, there's a real reluctance on parts of lots of folks to apologize for something, as if it's a sign of weakness or an admission, or somehow will put them in a bad place legally down the road. There's often a reluctance to apologize, but as anyone, as an armchair therapist myself, I'll tell you, you know, healing begins with an apology, but not just an apology, but a sincere apology. I agree that that's got to be a big part of any reparations plan. And I think we're going to talk a little bit about that with Ms. Taifa.
I was just thinking about our conversation and about the importance of apologies. And as a highly opinionated young woman, I sometimes have, you know, a problem apologizing, especially if it's something I think I'm right about. One of the things that we have to think about when we talk about apologies is in the form of reparations and being a part of reparations is that apologies don't necessarily, they're not contingent on whether you're right in your eyes or not. It depends on whether or not you have harmed somebody and you want to move forward in your relationship with that person or group, and you are sincere about moving forward. Rightness and wrongness doesn't have a role to play in an apology if you want to maintain or develop or nurture a relationship further. That's the point where I think it hinges on with African Americans, because I think a lot of African Americans, and I don't want to speak for all African Americans, but it feels like that we've gotten the "I'm sorry you feel that way" apology, or the "can you get over it already" apology. And this country also, you know, expects people to, you know, then forgive and forget once they get an apology. What I've learned over the years is that a true apology does not come with a qualifier or a request for forgiveness from the person you're issuing it to. We have a lot to learn. Even something as simple as an apology that we learned back in kindergarten, I think we're still on that.
I think the basics of this are pretty simple. You know, if you take a look at polling data and talks about asking the typical American, do you believe that racism exists? Do you believe that certain minority groups in this country have it harder? Do you believe that the legacy of slavery is still with us today and impacting African Americans? There's a huge divide in the polling data on what white Americans believe and what Black Americans believe on these basic questions. I think what you said about the irrelevance of whether you're right or wrong, but that the apology is a first step. Even if you say, well, I didn't do anything, maybe my ancestors did, but I didn't do anything, I think that largely is besides the point. And as long as people are still caught up in this loop of, well, I didn't do it, or I don't agree that things are as bad as people say they are, or if we even have basic disagreements on what the root causes of the problem are, can we define what a racist is? You know, one of the most divisive questions you can ask, you know, a survey taker is, do you believe that President Trump, for instance, is a racist? Now, regardless of what our views are on the subject, I can tell you there's a big gap in the opinion in the United States over whether he is a racist. Although it seems a little off topic, just the basic facts that would support an apology are often in dispute. And I think in order to get past this, to get to healing, we almost have to put aside what our respective views are on whether or not, you know, something bad happened or whether an apology is merited. I think an apology has to come, and then we can start with the healing.
Well, it's going to definitely be an interesting conversation and something that I think we should think about, not only as it relates to reparations, but just being here in Washington, how we just work with each other and start from a place of healing before we can move on with policy. Healed in whole policy is better than broken and unforgiving policy. So I hope we can all take a lesson from that.
I'm more positive and optimistic about this than I have ever been. And it's not just because we've had a hearing on the subject in the Congress, or we've got presidential candidates who are talking about it. I see it, you know, in society more broadly, the recognition that we've got to address some of the systemic problems before we can get to specific problems. And so I'm going to remain an optimist about this. And reparations, I think, is a critical ingredient to the solution. So let's get on with it.
All right. But before we begin, let's hear a message from Mark Morial, President and CEO of the National Urban League.
I'm Mark Morial, and this is your To Be Equal moment. A leadership gap, inadequate funding and staffing, along with a deliberate campaign to intimidate immigrants and communities of color, all make the 2020 census among the most challenging in American history. Nonetheless, we must be counted. That was my testimony before a special field hearing of the U.S. House Committee on Oversight and Reforms, Subcommittee on Civil Rights and Civil Liberties, regarding the 2020 census. The hearing called Get Counted, the Importance of the Census to State and Local Communities, was held at Queens Community College at the request of Congress members Carolyn Maloney and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Days after the hearing, irrefutable evidence emerged to bolster my testimony that the citizenship question is nothing but a sad ploy to rob vulnerable communities of their constitutional political power. Computer records from a political strategist who played a key role in adding the citizenship question authored a study concluding that the question would allow lawmakers to draft even more extreme gerrymandered maps to shift power away from targeted vulnerable communities. That's right. The whole idea of the citizenship question is to allow gerrymandering. Let's say it as clearly as we can. The citizenship question is a ploy to allow political and racially motivated gerrymandering. That's why it shouldn't be part of the 2020 census. During the field hearing in Queens, I testified that the racial and political polarization of our society puts at risk the most important elements of our representational democracy. Distrust of government is historically high now, and the upcoming presidential election threatens to politicize the process. Hostility towards immigrants, emanating from the highest offices in the land, has created a climate of fear, which could inhibit people from responding. But we cannot let that happen, and we must combat these threats. An inaccurate census will deprive communities of accurate data for the most federally produced statistics. What are those? The Consumer Price Index, the Centers for Disease Control, the National Center for Educational Statistics, and a host of others. Many important programs, Medicaid, the Community Development Block Grant Program, the State Children's Health Insurance Program, all rely on an accurate census to determine where these important investments that support vulnerable communities should be focused. An inaccurate census can deprive communities of critical social, demographic, and economic research conducted by think tanks, academic institutions, and the private sector. Indeed, the National Urban League's own State of Black America report makes extensive use of census-derived data. For an accurate State of Black America, we need a complete count and an accurate census. Importantly, an inaccurate census can deprive communities of fair political representation in the U.S. Congress, the Electoral College, state legislatures, city councils, county legislatures, and where people elect judges in the judicial branch also. We need a complete count and an accurate census. Therefore, we urge every one of you, every community, every institution, to get involved and to encourage our neighbors, family members, church members, co-workers to participate in the census, to count everyone in the household, including babies, foster children, and extended families. It's that important. We must count everyone in each house. It is important, safe, and easy. We urge Congress to continue to be aggressive, to hold oversight hearings to shed light on the issues the public needs to know about regarding census readiness, cybersecurity, the census communication plan, field infrastructure. The public has a right to know, and in 2020, an accurate count and a complete count is a necessity and a must. I'm Mark Morial, and this has been your 2B Equal Moment.
We're very excited today to have a special guest to talk about reparations. And we have with us today Ms. Nikichi Taifa, Esquire, who comes to us as the founder of the Taifa Group, who is a social justice attorney and activist here in Washington, D.C. For those of us in the movement who think of D.C. as home, well, she is one of our own homegrown attorneys and activists. She's lived in D.C. all of her life, and despite her travels all over the world, she calls home Washington, D.C.
Absolutely.
So thank you for being here with us today. We'd like to start off by talking just a little bit about some of the work that you do about reparations. In some of our earlier podcasts, we've talked about reparations with an economist, with a lawyer. Although you are a lawyer, you do approach reparations from a slightly different vantage. So can you talk about some of the work that you've done in this space?
Absolutely. Well, I'm a lawyer, but I'm also an advocate, and I am an activist. And I've been actually working on this issue of reparations ever since I was in high school, I guess you could say. But more recently, I'm a founding member of NCOBRA, which is the National Coalition of Blacks for Reparations in America, which I would say served to bring the issue of reparations into the 21st century. NCOBRA worked very closely with John Conyers in 1989 when he first introduced the Commission to Study Reparation Proposals for African Americans Act. And I'm also a commissioner on the National African American Reparations Commission, NARC, which is convened by the Institute of the Black World 21st Century. So I do most of my reparations work, my advocacy work, through those two organizational vehicles.
Great. So the issue of reparations is kind of a difficult one for a lot of people to wrap their brains around because we are really very removed from reparations, as we know. But it's also a very difficult issue because it's more than just land and money that was taken from African descendants. It was also a lot of psychological and socioeconomic effects of slavery and Black codes and also Jim Crow. So how can these issues be factored into the work that we do around reparations today?
Well, they absolutely must be factored in. They absolutely must be a vital part of the whole quest for reparations. There's been intergenerational harm, intergenerational trauma. There's been psychic injury. There's been psychological injury. And all of those must be part of the reparations healing package. We are harmed. We have been a people that have been subjected to such terror. Okay, terror, not just with respect to our bodies and our families, but to our identity as well. We must never short shrift the impact of the enslavement era and its impacts on us, whether it's in the psychic area, whether it's in the health area, whether it's in the educational arena, whether it's in the sociological arena, the economic arena, the punishment system arena. All of these are continuing impacts, the health arena. I mean, as you mentioned earlier, I do a lot of international travel. And if you go to the Caribbean countries, one of the persons was telling me that there were so many people walking around with missing limbs, missing limbs because of diabetes, because, you know, in their ancestral DNA, you know, they were cutting that cane and, you know, it was a sugar economy and those health impacts passed on through the generations. So the diabetes is just off the chain. It's off the chain here, too, but it's really off the chain in the Caribbean. When you talk about a stress, high blood pressure, hypertension, all of that is within our ancestral lineage. You know, it doesn't just go away when the 13th Amendment says neither slavery nor voluntary servitude shall exist. We'll leave the except clause alone for just one moment. But those impacts remain. And that's why reparations is not just for the enslavement period, it's for all of these lingering impacts above. And identity, when you talked about psychological, identity is a main part of it. My name, as she says, Nkechi Taifa. I was born in the 50s, and I can assure you my mama did not name me Nkechi Taifa in the 50s. It was a name that I adopted during the mid-70s, actually, because I wanted to be self-determining, okay? I wanted to recapture just some of that African personality that had been stolen from me. I wanted to have some of that cultural connectivity, I guess you could say. So I just went to African Names Book and I chose an African name. But it should not have had to come to that, okay? It should have been part of our upbringing, a love for our ancestry and our history, but we didn't have any of that. And that's part of the harm.
Right.
You know, Dr. Du Bois wrote a lot about this notion of double consciousness, about Africans in America having to have a separateness or a two-ness about them. Double consciousness was the phrase he coined to talk about the constant struggle between Black conception of self-identity with Afroculture while living in white America. Ellison, likewise, talked about this intellectual invisibility experienced by enlightened Blacks. Does the weight of this two-ness, of this duality that African Americans have to labor under, does that factor in any way to the mental health impacts that you've just described, the lingering impacts? How would you characterize that weight on the current health of African Americans?
You really hit it on the nail, Clint. And you hit it on the nail because many times we as African people in this country have to pretend like we're somebody else. Going to law school, you know, being in a predominantly white law school, I have to pretend like, you know, I'm someone else. I can't really be my true self. I try to be. I wear my hair natural. I have my African name. But, you know, there's always that dichotomy where you can't really put everything out there because you have to blend in. You have to mainstream yourself or you're not going to advance in this society. One of the reasons, actually, I'll just say it point blank, that I decided to go to law school is because some of the things that I knew I wanted to talk about and express, I knew that it would not pass a laugh test. No one would take me seriously unless I had an Esquire behind my name and an attorney in front of my name. So if I wanted to talk about reparations, I had to make sure that I fit into what this country considered to be credentialed. Right. Yeah, you know, you got it.
Yeah.
But it's a dichotomy because, yes, I believe in being credentialed, but I'm an activist at heart, okay? And a grassroots person. And what the things that I'm saying should be able to be accepted, just being a sister on the block as opposed to an attorney in the suite. So I found myself many times having to pretend that I'm someone else, or not just pretend, but not really express the totality of my being. I don't know how many opportunities I lost because I chose to be self-determining and use an African name. I don't know how many opportunities I lost because I decided to keep the natural coil in my hair. I don't know how many opportunities I lost because of the rich melanin in my skin. But all of these are things that we are faced with as we go about in American society trying to advance.
One of the things that you said that really caught my attention, especially as a Black woman who is also navigating different areas and career and things like that, is it sounds, just listening to someone else saying it, it sounds so exhausting to have to think about so many things and feel like, you know, I can't just run on my own expertise. I have to have, you know, letters behind my name. And one of the things that I've really thought about when it comes to reparations and how do we repair the psyche of Black people is the idea of resting. It always seems like we are expected to work harder, work longer, to not take a break. You know, there's this perception that we are lazy, which historically is false. You can't build a country and you're lazy. Rest seems to be something that, when I think about reparations as a Black woman, is very important to me, that I haven't found the sufficient amount of rest in my life. How, in your ideal mind, would a psychic reparation look for you?
Well, first of all, I like that concept of rest. Oh, my goodness, I need some of that. And you're right, we always have to prove as if we're better than the... We have to be better in order to even compete at the same level as our Caucasian peers. We have to do better. We have to be better. We have to make better grades. You know, all of the above. So, you know, it's really interesting that you asked, what would reparations look like on a psychic level? To me, I have not had the leisure or the rest to even think about that.
Oh, wow.
I've always been struggling in terms of making sure everyone understands that reparations is a legitimate concept, that it's a well-established principle of international law, which the United States has, in fact, been a part of in the past and should be a part of with respect to this. So I've always, like, been on the front lines of trying to just get to first base, I guess you could say. You're taking me to like third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth base. But that's good because that's where we need to be. We need to visualize, okay, what it will look like. I mean, I would like it to be a situation where my children, my grandchildren won't have to think that they have to prove themselves, won't be subjected to microaggressions, okay, won't be subjected to overt racism, to white supremacy, that they can advance the way they want to advance on their own and on their own time with their own expertise without having to worry about, are they going to be perceived in a certain way or anything along those lines? I would like to be in a situation where knowing that there is no gap, no wealth gap, knowing that there are no health disparities, knowing that there are no negative consequences with respect to the criminal punishment system. Those are the things I would like to see if there were really true reparations or true truth and reconciliation, a true reckoning. Those are some of the processes. I would like a healing, not just with respect to us, African people in this country, but healing of the whole country. Because let me tell you, white folk need to be healed.
Mm-mm.
Okay. See, it's not just enough that the healing take place. This is what I call internal reparations, when we are part of this healing process, and Black people in this country are healing ourselves. But the whole country needs healing. And I think this should be a time where other people take stock, okay, of their history, of their accountability, okay, and be about the healing of their community so that both communities can come together and move forward. That's what I would see as some kind of true progress.
So although we are nowhere near reaching a colorblind society, this Valhalla where, you know, Dr. King talked about people are looking at the content of our character instead of the color of our skin, all of the things that you just laid out, I think of as a colorblind society. We've had some Supreme Court justices who look at their watch and they say, it's about time. I think we're here. I think we'll reach a colorblind society. Let's start peeling back all of these protections, all of these remedies that we put in place, because we should be at a colorblind society. Clearly, we're not there yet. But I wanted to talk to you about this period in which we're in, where people are really talking about reparations in a serious way, in a way that has never been talked about. We talked a little bit off microphone about the fact that years ago, if you talked about reparations, people thought you were some sort of wild-eyed militant or lunatic, right? Why don't you talk to us a little bit about the moment that we're in, where we have the chairman of the Federal Reserve who's saying, we think that some of the endemic problems with unemployment and poverty are a direct result of the legacy of slavery. I almost fell out of my chair. Jerome Powell, the current chairman of the Federal Reserve, said this in an interview just a few weeks ago. Now we have presidential candidates who are talking about reparations. This must be a validation of the past 40 years of your work in a way that maybe you didn't even anticipate 2 or 3 years ago. So can you talk to us a little bit about the moment that you think we're in and how we got here? And are you surprised by it as well?
Well, we are in a very auspicious moment right now, and one in which I would not have predicted that it would happen at this time. I'm not surprised, and I'm not surprised because of the level of repression that's going on in this country right now, I'm not surprised, because I think the blinders were taken off of people's eyes after the Obama administration and seeing the depths to which this country has sunk. So I'm not surprised with respect to any of those things. But one of the things I will say, and I want to make sure that this is completely understandable by everyone, the question of fight for reparations did not just happen with the 2020 candidates. It didn't just happen with Ta-Nehisi Coates' brilliant treatise in the Atlantic magazine. It didn't even happen 10 years earlier with Randall Robbins' phenomenal book on the subject. The issue of reparations has been long standing. Many folk don't know that the first petition was around in the 1700s by a formerly enslaved woman named Belinda Voyle, who petitioned the Massachusetts legislature for a pension from her former enslaved. And she was, in fact, given several shillings as a pension. I mean, I know that's pittance, but there's something we don't learn about in school. We don't learn about Callie House and the Ex-Slave Mutual Bounty and Pension Association in the late 1800s with Reverend Isaiah Dickerson, which had over 100,000 dues-paying members. It was really the first mass-based reparations movement in this country. Then you go on down through Marcus Garvey and talked about repatriation with repatriation to Africa, but with repair, with compensation to begin to be able to reinsert that African personality that was lost. During the 50s and the 60s, we had the great phenomenon, who most folk don't even know anything about, Queen Mother Audley Moore of Harlem, who had kept that issue alive during all of those decades, primarily the 50s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, and submitted petitions before the United Nations on behalf of her Ethiopian Women's Association. She was a sister from Harlem, okay, doing all of this. Most folk don't realize that Martin Luther King and Why We Can't Wait talked about reparation, not quite used that particular word, but he talked about the concept and talk about that bounce check, okay? A lot of people don't know that James Forman, civil rights activist, interrupted Sunday service at Riverside Baptist Church in New York, calling for the churches to give reparations. And guess what? Some of them did pay some money. It was, you know, hilarious. And it went on. The Republic of New Africa talked about in its Declaration of Independence, it said, we claim no rights from the United States other than those rights belonging to human beings anywhere in the world. And these include the right to reparations to us for the grievous injuries sustained by ourselves and our ancestors by reason of U.S. lawlessness. The Black Panther Party, point number three of its 10-point program, talked about 40 acres and a mule. The Nation of Islam's publications, all of this, till you get down to the late 80s, when you get down to the passage of the Japanese American Redress Bill, the Civil Liberties Act of 1988, which provided reparations to Japanese Americans, $20,000 to each Japanese American detention camp survivor, trust fund to be used to educate Americans about the suffering of the Japanese, a formal apology from the United States government, and clemency, a pardon for all those who resisted detention camp internment. So in COBRA comes along, the National Coalition of Blacks for Reparations in America, and says, well, if you could do it for the Japanese Americans, you can do it for Blacks in this country. And we work closely with John Conyers to get that bill introduced. So the history of the struggle for reparations has been very much long standing all the way down through today. So today, when we see the 2020 candidates, we need to recognize that they are standing on the shoulders, okay, of all of this past history. And we need to know and recognize this past history and recognize it as part of a legitimate struggle.
One of the things that you mentioned that has had a lot of conversation is the issue of a official unfettered apology for the institution of slavery and all of its aftermath. What do you think is the push? What is the need for our community or even the country to hear an official unfettered apology about slavery from the government? What Yes. would that psychically do for our country?
So let me just say this. First of all, I consider four elements in reparations claim for African-Americans in this country. Number one, the formal acknowledgement that there was a historical wrong with an unfettered apology from the United States government. Number two, a recognition that the injury continues to this day. A commitment to redress from the federal government, from academic institutions, from religious institutions, from corporations, from private estates, whoever was part of that harm, and the actual compensation in whatever form or forms are agreed upon. So when we talk about apology, it is absolutely essential, just from a psychological point of view, that there be accountability, that there be apology, that there be a recognition, that there be an acknowledgement that there was, in fact, harm done. That's essential to any type of reparation. Every single reparation scenario that I've seen has encompassed an apology. And not an apology as what happened in the Senate, where it said, okay, we will apologize, but you cannot use our apology as any quest for reparations. That's what the Senate actually did in, I think that was in 2009.
And if you recall, there were a number of senators who refused to issue the apology or to join on to the resolution of apology because they said they weren't part of the Senate when that happened. Even our Senate leader today, Mitch McConnell, has been poking fun, I'd say, in deriding this notion of reparations.
Yeah, McConnell said, well, you all had Obama as president. That's reparations enough. I couldn't believe it.
I don't know if you heard his remarks where he also said there are two things that Barack Obama and I agree upon. One is there shouldn't be reparations, and two, that we both had ancestors who were slaveholders.
I missed that one.
this was the United States Senate leader who made this remark about reparations.
It is a sad, sad commentary. This country has not seen fit to apologize for these over 400 years of, I just got to call it terrorism, that occurred on this soil. It's even more egregious when we realize, we learned this in school, but we don't think about it in this context, but that the United States Constitution actually sanctioned the enslavement in three separate sections. In one section, it sanctioned the continued importation of what I call African prisoners of war to any state that might desire us enslaved people until the year 1808. That's in the Constitution. It relegated our status to that of 3/5 of a white man. That's in the Constitution. It mandated that any African, even if he or she had reached a free state, none of us were safe. And it was a constitutional duty of any and every single white man, woman, or child to deliver us up to the government. That was the future to slave provision in the Constitution. You know, Clint, Tony, I never understood why Harriet Tubman had to go all the way to Canada. I just didn't understand that. But it was because of the future to slavery. It was because Pennsylvania and New York were no longer safe. Nowhere in the United States was safe. Even if you were a free person, you had to go all the way outside of the country, all the way to Canada, in order not to be touched. We don't learn about it like that, and we should. And that's another problem with the psychological and the psychic harm, the educational deprivations that we've been subjected to. I remember in elementary school just being embarrassed. And this was during the time they were all black schools in elementary school, being embarrassed for the little paragraph about slavery and picking cotton. And I'm sitting, I don't know why I'm embarrassed, but it's just... Yeah, and it was real quick, and it just glossed over, and then that was it. And then later on, growing up in college and law school, whenever there was anything dealing with black people or slavery, everyone always looks at Nikichi. What do you think about that? Like, I have to be the explainer for the whole race. Anything that touches on race, I find that offensive as well. So there's just so much to unpack. There really is. An apology is the first step towards that process.
I read something from an economist. I think he is a person who actually was able to kind of tally up what the bill, so to speak, would be for the United States for slavery occurring between 1776 and 1865, which is not even, you know, the whole of it. His family was originally from Germany, and he said it gave him a lot of healing in the ability to look his fellow man, his fellow neighbor, in the eye when the government formally apologized for the Holocaust and gave reparations, as it were, to those victims and their families. Because even as a person who was not a victim. For him to see that happen was restorative for him, and it made him feel at ease to talk to his fellow man because he didn't have that wall of guilt or responsibility or wrongdoing between them. So do you think the U.S. could benefit, race relations in general could benefit from, like you said, a formal apology that is unfettered and to show the citizens of this current age that, you know, we can move forward together, not just this is an African-American thing, this is an American thing. Do you think we are missing opportunities to really see the America at its greatest potential by not doing it?
So that's the first step. Apology is the first step, but it's not the end all. I mean, Clinton apologized when he went over there to Africa. He issued an apology. This was not a congressional apology, but it is a first step, and it is a necessary first step, but it's not the end. You can't just apologize, and then, you know, the wall is gone, and, you know, kumbaya, and let's all get along. It must come with compensation. And I say that, and when I say compensation, compensation in whatever form or forms are agreed upon. Reparations comes as a result of a settlement, a negotiation, a discussion, a fact-finding, a truth and reconciliation, all of those factors. It's not just for one person to tally up and, well, you know, it's been this many years and this and that and blah, 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 blah. No amount, no amount of money will ever compensate for what our people have been through. No amount can satisfy the trauma that we've been through. No amount can recompense the countless numbers of Black women who were raped. They say that the average age, listen to this, the average age of Black females during the enslavement era giving birth, the average age was 13. Mm-hmm. So if the average age was 13, then you're talking about you had 10-year-olds, 11-year-olds giving birth. I mean, I'm just saying, you know, no amount of compensation can satisfy the numbers of Black women also. I'm going to stick with Black women for a moment who underwent torturous gynecological experiments devoid of anesthesia, which led to modern medicine today, modern gynecology. Every time you got your feet in them stirrups, you know, I think of what some of my female line ancestors went through. No amount of money can repay looking up and seeing your father, your brother, your uncle, your mother, your sister hanging from that limb of the tree, okay, with body parts cut off. No amount can recompense the hordes of white men, women, and children who crowded around these lynching carnivals. They were essentially carnivals.
After church.
After church, you know, schools were let out to be able to participate in the holiday. So I say no amount, but there is a negotiation and there is a settlement, but there is a recognition that we always still must be vigilant so that the continuing vestiges don't continue.
Right. So recently we've learned that as many as 15 Caribbean countries filed a lawsuit against several European countries in the international courts for damages caused during the slave trade, including psychological trauma, chronic health conditions that come from, as you said, you know, just not having access to good nutrition that persists in the dehumanizing treatment during slavery. So do you think U.S. descendants have a similar claim to make? And what do you think is stopping this lawsuit from being filed?
Okay, well, there have been lawsuits filed. I mean, there have been quite a number of lawsuits filed. One was filed in Tulsa, Oklahoma, where you have living descendants. John Franklin was one who wrote From Slavery to Freedom back in the day. You had living descendants who were in their 90s and 100 and all like that. And the government still said, oh, no, it's not enough. It's too attenuated. What's a lawsuit? Cato versus United States, thrown out of court on statute of limitations grounds. Other issues, laches. One of the reasons why I always talk about the continuation, the continuous struggle for reparations is to really show that laches, which basically says if you sleep on your claim, then you can't benefit from it. Okay, you had this claim 400 or 500 years ago. You didn't do anything about it, so you can't come into court now. Well, what we're saying is that there's never been a point of time when we did not raise any of these issues. That's why I always talk about that continuous cycle. The state of Oklahoma did, in fact, provide a scholarship fund and an apology for the victims of the Tulsa Massacre, but the lawsuit was thrown out of court. This was a lawsuit filed by Charles Ogletree and Johnny Cochran and Adjo Ayotoro and others. In Rosewood, Florida, another instance where a whole Black community was just almost wiped out, just makes your blood boil. Rosewood, Florida. Florida paid money in reparations to descendants of that. Just in Chicago, just recently, the city council passed an ordinance providing, and they called it reparations, this was several years ago, for victims of police torture in Chicago that had gone on for decades. And they also called upon the school system in Chicago to teach about that torture and the response that the community gave about that. And it also established money for monuments to talk about that era. But let me just tell you this. There's so much we don't know about. I just found out about something I had never even heard about before. I talked about Rosewood. I talked about Tulsa. I never heard of Wilmington. Wilmington, North Carolina. There's a documentary that just came out recently called Wilmington on Fire. Another instance, a whole Black community. We're talking about Black businesses, stores, schools. They owned everything. They were very wealthy. They were very prominent. And they essentially, the white folks essentially took the Black doctors, the Black dentists, the Black lawyers, and said, you all get on this train and you get out of town now. And if you come back, we're going to kill you. And they all had to leave. And they left their businesses. They left their homes, their houses. All of that was subject to foreclosure. I had never heard about this before. But these are things that are beginning to come up now that this issue of reparations is beginning to become mainstream. So I'm hoping that there will be more lawsuits, but I don't think that the courts are going to be the answer for this. I think it is going to be the legislature and come about in the way in which the Civil Liberties Act of 1988, i.e. the Japanese American Redress Bill, came about.
You talked about a lot of instances where specific events were tried in courts and there were reparations given to the descendants or the actual victims of those instances. But going back to the international court, do we have any kind of recompense in that area if the United States government fails to move forward with a commission and subsequent action regarding reparations for slavery?
So let me just say this. There have been international appeals for reparations that Black people have brought in the past. In 2001, there was the World Conference Against Racism that was held in Durban, South Africa, which actually called the Atlantic slave trade a crime against humanity that it was and always has been. Just recently, just yesterday, the Howard University Thurgood Marshall Civil Rights Center filed a petition with the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights for reparations, for a thematic hearing on reparations on the enslavement and the continuing impacts in various systems, including the criminal punishment system. Entities have been to Geneva raising the issue. So this is nothing new. We have gone to international bodies. I think the difference between the Caribbean countries, the Caribbean nations, and Black people in this country, we can call ourselves a nation, the Black nation in North America, you know, but there is no real separate entity, okay? It's not a government. It's not like we're the government of Jamaica, one of the CARICOM companies, or the Barbados, or, you know, St. Thomas or St. Vincent and the Grenadines. You know, we're Black folk in the United States. And I think that's been one of the hindrances, I guess you could say, that I think we really need to look at and need to be redressed. But there has been resort to the international arena, and I think that that should continue as well. And no, we are not waiting for H.R. 40 to pass. Like I said, it's already been 30 years. The National African American Reparations Commission a body of which I am a part of, a commissioner of, is already starting that process long before reparations became popular within the past year. NARC had set apart trying to come up with a 10-point preliminary reparations program. It was modeled off of the CARICOM, the Caribbean Nations 10-point program as well. But NARC doesn't say that it speaks for all Black people in this country. What NARC, National African American Reparations Commission, is seeking to do is to go to various cities and different communities and hold town hall meetings and hear from, listen to the communities in terms of what do you want, you know, how, what do you feel could be an adequate compensatory package for reparations? Are we talking about land? Are we talking about cash? Are we talking about scholarships? Are we talking about monuments? Are we talking about, you know, any of the different things that are there? We talk about healing. Are we talking about repatriation? Just what are the different possibilities that can go into a reparation settlement? And NARC is taking all of this information and putting it together to help to pump up its 10-point program. And if H.R. 40 does pass and there is an actual federally chartered commission official from the United States government, NARC can transfer that information to that commission so it can be part of the official process. But no, we don't wait. And we don't wait for internal reparations either. We need to start, and we are starting, the healing process now. Just talking about reparations is healing. It's cathartic. It's helping to close some of those wounds, whether they're physical or whether they're psychological. It's helping to bring closure to that era of which there still remains so many unsettled questions.
And, you know, that is the perfect way to end our podcast today. That is the perfect sentiment. I couldn't express it any better. One question for you, for our listeners out there who I know have been riveted by what you've had to say today. If anyone who listens to this podcast wants to follow you and join the work that you're doing on this issue, how can we do it? Do you have any social media handles or any other things that you can point us to so that we can follow your work and support it?
Yes, well, I really would like people to do it through the organizations I work with. NCOBRA is NCOBRAonline.org. That's NCOBRAonline.org. And NARC, the website, is managed by the Institute of Black World 21st Century and actually is the most comprehensive embodiment of material on reparations that I have seen. And that website is IBW21.org. That's IBW standing for Institute of the Black World 21.org. And my name, Nkechi Taifa. I'm on Twitter, Nkechi _Taifa. If you just start Googling up my name, I come up.
All right. Well, we're going to start following you if we haven't already.
Yes,
you can count
absolutely
on at least two new followers.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for your time. And definitely thank you so much for your work and your inspiration that you've given to us to dig deeper into this topic. So thank you so much.
Okay, it was my pleasure.
In our affiliate spotlight, we would like to recognize the president and CEO of the Columbia Urban League, Mr. J.T. McLawhorn, who recently took a firm stand urging citizens not to take lightly a video of a local South Carolina teen spewing racist rhetoric while shooting a pair of sneakers meant to depict a Black man. In the aftermath, he questioned the school and law enforcement's failures to immediately take the teen's clear threats to shoot up a local school seriously, as well as their delay in immediately notifying parents of the threats. He urged schools to adopt a zero-tolerance policy for hate speech and to work closely with law enforcement to report and recognize red flags for domestic terrorism. Thank you, CEO McLawhorn, for your leadership in the Columbia community, for sounding the alarm and speaking truth to power to protect our students from hate speech and violence. If you would like to learn more about the work of the Columbia Urban League, follow them on Twitter at COLA, C-O-L-A, Urban League, and visit their website at columbiaurbanleague.org. As always, you can follow us on Twitter at NUL Policy for updates. Be sure to rate us on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Google Play. And kudos to our production team at Podfly. And thank you for listening to For the Movement, presented by the National Urban League.